Well, Vicki, it sure is good to see you back in your regular seat, and we're thankful for the good that has been accomplished by your surgery, but certainly we concerned about other side effects and things that you're dealing with, but really, really great to see you today. Good to have everyone here with us. I don't know how your morning got started today, but I can tell you that my morning got started, as it always does, with bloodshed and mayhem, because what usually happens at our house on Sunday is while I'm in my study looking over my sermon notes and finishing things up, Christy comes into the living room to do a few things, and she always turns on Law and Order. So my Sundays are almost always marked by usually murder, sometimes other crimes, but it's almost always murder. But I don't mind it because I like that show. I really liked it, especially back in the early days of the show. I'm just kind of curious, how many of you have seen at least one episode of Law and Order? All right, well, that's almost all of us here. That's a testimony to how popular it is. For the two of you that have not seen Law and Order, as the name of the show indicates, the first half of each episode is the law part, and that's when the detectives are investigating a crime scene. And then the second half of the show is the order part, and that's when it goes to trial, and the story usually follows the assistant district attorney and his fellow counselors as they try to prosecute the case. A lot of the episodes of Law and Order focus on how difficult it is to get people to actually testify, to be willing to go up on the witness stand in a public court of law. Sometimes it's because they could, you know, maybe be harmed by those that they testify against. There have been some episodes about the mob where if they offer testimony, the mob may come back to eventually get them. And other times it's just because it's a loved one or a good friend of theirs that they don't want to get in trouble. A lot of the episodes show the kind of pressure that the DA's office will put on people to get them to testify, but they have to do that because if you're a prosecutor, if you don't have witnesses, you don't have a case. So you have to get people to testify. Now, I was thinking about this in light of what we're going to look at today in the last part of John chapter 5, because in many respects, what happens here in this passage is very much like a courtroom setting in which the central issue are witnesses. Who will bear testimony? Who will bear witness to Jesus as the Son of God? Now, you might remember in last week's exciting episode of preaching here at Valrico that we looked at Jesus' defense of his healing on the Sabbath day, in which he says a couple of amazing things. In chapter 5, he says in verse 17, "My Father is working until now, and I'm working," basically equating himself with God. In fact, the Jews certainly take that as the idea in verse 18 that he was calling God his own Father, making himself equal with God. Now, anybody can call themselves the Son of God. Anybody can say they are equal with God. But the issue is, what kind of evidence can you offer? What kind of testimony can you give to support that claim? So if you look here in John chapter 5, in verse 31, Jesus raises the legal issue when he says, "If I alone bear witness about myself, my testimony is not true." We all know under the law of Moses, the famous standard for witnesses in Deuteronomy chapter 19, at the mouth of two or three witnesses, every word will be established. And so Jesus says that if it was just me testifying about myself, well, that wouldn't exactly be valid testimony. We're going to need witnesses, and that's what today's passage is going to be about. Jesus is going to produce five witnesses. Now, they're not all of the same rank, but there are five witnesses who are going to testify about Jesus, and eagerly testify, by the way, that he is, in fact, the Son of God. Verse 32, "There is another who bears witness about me, and I know the testimony he bears about me is true." Now, who is Jesus talking about here in verse 32? This other person who's going to bear testimony about him. Well, you might be tempted to think that he's talking about the guy mentioned in the next verse, which is John the Baptist. Except in verse 34, Jesus says that he doesn't need testimony from people. And in verse 36, he spells out that the testimony he's really talking about is even greater than that that could come from John. So there is an ultimate witness that Jesus has in mind. And as it will become clear, the ultimate witness, the prime witness for Jesus, is going to be the Father. However, John the Baptist did also serve in a secondary role, an important purpose as a witness. And so he is the first witness that you might say Jesus puts on the stand here in our text today. So verse 33 says, you sent to John. Do you remember this? You remember way back a couple months ago when we started in chapter 1? It says in verse 19 that a delegation from the Jewish leaders in Jerusalem came to John and they started interrogating him. Hey, who are you? Are you the prophet? Are you the Christ? Are you the expected one? And so Jesus says, I know that you sent to John. Verse 33 goes on to say, he's borne witness to the truth. Do you remember the next day in John 1, after the Jewish delegation came, what did John say? He saw Jesus, looked at his disciples, and said, behold, the Lamb of God who takes away the sin of the world. So Jesus says, I know you sent to John, and I also know that John bore witness to the truth. Not only on that day, but John, when he baptized Jesus, heard the voice from heaven speak and say, this is my beloved son. As a matter of fact, back in chapter 1 and verse 34, John says, I've seen and borne witness that this is the Son of God. And so John the Baptist is indeed a credible eyewitness to Jesus' identity as the Son of God. And yet, it's kind of strange here in John 5. It's almost like Jesus diminishes the value of his testimony in verse 34. Not that the testimony I receive is from man. Well, wait a minute. You did receive testimony from men. John the Baptist, a lot of other people. Remember Nathanael in chapter 1? Rabbi, you are the Son of God. You're the King of Israel. Nicodemus, you're a teacher sent from God. The woman of Samaria, could this be the Christ? He's a prophet. The man whose child was near death that Jesus healed believes him. There's a lot of people have testified about Jesus. So what does Jesus mean here in verse 34 when he says, not that the testimony I receive is from man? Well, I think the point Jesus is making is, while it is true that many different people have borne testimony about me, by comparison, the Father's testimony will far outstrip anything anyone else can say, so that ultimately, at the end of the day, the only testimony that truly matters is God's, simply because he ranks so high. The same principle is kind of at work at my house. When I make some very humorous and clever remark, which I do on a regular basis, but quite often when I make one of my very clever and humorous, ingenious, really, remarks, Mrs. Scott will say, I don't think that's that funny. And then that's when I go to my office and I produce this, the 2006 Cheatham County Community Theater Award for Featured Actor, given to Shane Scott. And I show Christy, hey, here's the testimony. This is what I'm saying is funny. I've got proof right here. Now, it was with three other people in the quartet. But anyway, that doesn't really matter. It's my art right here, all right? Well, the point is, I'm trying to convey to her that your testimony is okay, but this testimony is more important. Now, of course, really, if she doesn't think my jokes are funny, it bothers me, because like every husband, I crave my wife's approval and her admiration. And you know, the fact of the matter is, your wife may think you're a fantastic husband. Your wife may think you're the best husband in the world. But if God doesn't think you are, it's not going to matter. That's the point. And by the same token, what Jesus is saying is, look, I know a lot of different people, good people, righteous people, are bearing testimony to me. You just need to understand, the point he's making is, even as great as John the Baptist was, and there's no one born of woman greater than him, nevertheless, the testimony that's going to matter the most is the testimony of John himself. Well, then why even bring it up? I mean, Jesus is the one who says John bore witness. Well, he tells us at the end of verse 34. I say these things so that you may be saved. In other words, what he's saying is, I don't need John's testimony. You need his testimony. You respect him. You admire him. You listen to him. So I'm going to bring him up because I know it will help you come to understand who I am. Verse 35, he was a burning and shining lamp. It's a great illustration. And this, by the way, takes us back. I'm turning back to chapter 1. It takes us back to something John the Apostle tells us in the opening verses of the gospel when he says in verse 6, there was a man sent from God whose name was John. He came as a witness to bear witness about the light that all might believe through him. He was not the light. He came to bear witness about the light. Now compare that with what Jesus says here in John 5:35. He was a burning and shining lamp. He's not the light, he's the lamp. There's a difference, right? There's the source of light, and then what the lamp does is it magnifies it and it directs. And the lamp is important, but what's fundamentally important is the light itself. And what Jesus says is this was John's role. He's not the light. I'm the light. But he was a lamp. And insofar as a lamp reflects and directs the light, that's what John was doing in his testimony about me. And by the way, less, of course, than John the Baptist, but I mean, that's what we're supposed to be doing, right? Aren't we supposed to be reflections of the light of Jesus Christ? And aren't we, by our lives, supposed to be shining that light as it reflects and bounces off of us, so that we tell other people about who Jesus is? Now, we're no John the Baptist. I recognize that. In the world of lamps, you know, John the Baptist would be like a Tiffany, or, you know, beautiful, ornate, and precious. I might feel like I'm more like a rusted out old Coleman lantern, you know. But, you know, even a rusted out old lantern can still reflect light if the light's there. And the light of Jesus is always there. And even in our imperfection and weakness, just like John did, we can reflect the light of Jesus to other people so that they will come to him. And Jesus says that John was effective, at least temporarily. Verse 35 goes on to say, you were willing to rejoice for a while in his light. That's why Jesus brings it up. He said, I'm doing this for your benefit. And that's because he knew that the people celebrated the ministry of John. And so if they like John, then they ought to like the one on whom John put the spotlight. And that is, of course, Jesus himself. But as the Lord's already told us, there are greater witnesses. There is a greater witness than even John the Baptist himself. He has testimony from a higher source. So the next witness Jesus produces for us are actually the works of the Father. Verse 36. But the testimony that I have is greater than that of John, for the works that the Father has given me to accomplish, the very works that I am doing bear witness about me that the Father has sent me. Now, we've already seen Jesus use language like this back up in chapter 5 when he says in verse 20, the Father loves the Son and shows him all that he's himself doing. And I made the point to you last week that what Jesus means by this is when he turned water to wine, the Father showed him to do that. When he heals the nobleman's son from a distance, when he heals the lame man, that the Father is showing him all of these things. So now what Jesus is saying is, you don't have to take my word for it. Just simply look at the things. You've seen me do them. You've witnessed what I'm doing. These are things that God the Father has shown me to do. So they bear witness about me that the Father has sent me. But not everybody accepts this. Now, it's interesting. You remember 2 weeks ago, and last week, the story of the healing of the lame man, and then the criticism of the Jewish leaders. It's interesting to me, at no point do they ever deny Jesus did a miracle. You know, that didn't come up. They didn't say, well, you didn't really heal the lame man, or you weren't really lame, or, you know, you took, you know, aspirin, or, you know, arthritis, straight Tylenol. And that's nobody questions something happened. The problem is they filtered it out because they were fixated on their particular rabbinical regulations about the Sabbath. So actually, it's really not even in dispute that Jesus did great works. But just because Jesus did great works, that doesn't mean that the people are inherently going to believe in him if there is some prior prejudice that keeps them from believing in him. And so, look what Jesus says over in chapter 15. We'll just sneak ahead here a little bit. In chapter 15, Jesus says, if nothing else then, my works have at least accomplished this much. Over in chapter 15, he says in verse 24, John 15, 24, if I had not done among them the works that no one else did, they would not be guilty of sin. But now they've seen and hated both me and my Father. That's why they don't respond to the works Jesus did. They're the works of the Father, and the problem they have is ultimately with the Father. Jesus says, here's at least what my works have done. They've indicted you. Here's the evidence that shows you are in sin. You don't believe because the works have been so clear and manifest. But it isn't just the Father's works that bear testimony to Jesus. The Father himself does. He's the third witness that Jesus presents. So back to chapter 5, verse 37. And the Father who sent me has himself borne witness about me. Now Jesus doesn't exactly say here how the Father has borne witness. I mean, my mind immediately runs to the voice from heaven at the baptism of Jesus. This is my beloved Son. Or it could also go to the Mount of Transfiguration, where the same thing happens. Jesus is transfigured, and the voice from heaven says, this is my beloved Son. The point here, though, is not so much specifically how it is that the Father has borne witness, but just simply the fact that the Father has borne witness, and yet Jesus' Jewish opponents here have not accepted it. Look at how he points this out at the end of verse 37. His voice you have never heard, his form you have never seen. Now, if you have a really, really good memory, and you'd have to have a really good one, that last phrase, his form you have never seen, may ring a bell to you from the book of Deuteronomy. Because in Deuteronomy, when Moses, you know, he's talking to the generation that's just come through the wilderness, he's been retelling sort of the story of Israel, and now he's recounting what happened at Mount Sinai. And you remember, right, it's a very foreboding scene. Smoke, fire, earthquake. It's like a giant volcano. And you remember the voice of God speaks, and as a matter of fact, after God initially speaks, what did the people say? We can't bear to hear that. Moses, you talk. Let God talk to you. You talk to us. We can't even bear to hear the voice of God. All right, so when he reflects on that, Moses says to the people in Deuteronomy 4, then the Lord spoke to you out of the midst of the fire. You heard the sound of words, but saw no form. There was only a voice. Of course, God doesn't have a physical form that could be seen anyway. But he's making the point here that God is living. You didn't see his form, but you most certainly heard his voice. All right, now, every Jew would have believed that, would have accepted the fact that on Mount Sinai, the people heard God, but they didn't see him. So here in John 5:37, when Jesus says, his form you have never seen, well, that's just, you know, typical language right out of the Old Testament. The kicker is that Jesus says, his voice you have never heard. Now, that wasn't true of the people of Moses' day. They did hear the voice of God. But what Jesus is saying is, You're different than them. You're not listening to God. You have not heard his voice. In fact, he says you have never heard his voice. How are they supposed to hear God's voice? God doesn't speak from Mount Sinai still. Verse 38, you do not have his word abiding in you. And I think this actually might be what Jesus means when he says, the Father has borne testimony about me. The Father through his word. Word which was still accessible. Not being spoken audibly, of course, but still accessible through the scriptures. But what Jesus is saying is, here's your problem. The Father's bearing testimony to me through the word, and you don't listen to him. And so because you don't listen to him, what God is testifying to is completely lost on you. Which, by the way, you talk about a strong link between the Bible and God, Jesus connects it right here. Because what Jesus says is, if you're not listening to the Bible, you're not listening to God. And the consequence is tragic. Verse 39, you search the scriptures. Now, if you are like me and you're raised on the King James Version, it reads differently. Do you remember what it says? The King James says, search the scriptures. It's a command. And in Greek, this could be a command or it could be a statement of fact. Most likely, though, the way more modern versions render it is exactly what Jesus is saying. He's not commanding them. He's saying, here's what you already do. You're searching the scriptures because you think that in them you have eternal life. Can't you just imagine all the rabbis and the scribes, they're hunkered down, and they are just scouring the Bible. We know they were experts in the minutiae of the law. He says, because you think in them you have eternal life, and it is they that bear witness about me. The scriptures are indeed a source of life because they point us to Jesus, who is the life. But if you don't accept Jesus, then of course what the scriptures have to offer is lost on you. Jesus now gives us then a fourth witness, and that is the scriptures themselves. They bear witness about Jesus, but Jesus' contemporaries, by and large, don't want to find what they're supposed to be seeking. Verse 40. Yet you refuse to come to me that you may have life. You're poring over the Torah, the law, and the prophets, because you think this is how you're going to have life, and it is. But then when the one who fulfills, the one who these are all about, finally shows up, it's like you say, I don't want any of that. Now, you know, the secret behind preaching I probably should convey to you is that Christy writes all my sermons. So if it's ever a clunker, well, go blame her, all right? It was not my well, actually, every now and then, I want an illustration about something, and I run into a roadblock, and so I'll ask Christy to help. So I said to her, hey, I need an illustration about searching for something, and then when you find it, you don't want it. And she said, a husband. No, that's not actually what she said. So I mean, she came up with a perfect illustration. She said, so if you ever seen the movie A Christmas Story, so you remember little Ralph, he listens to the Little Orphan Annie radio show, and he gets his decoder ring because you're going to be a top secret agent. And so Little Orphan Annie then on the radio, they're going to give you this code, and then you use the ring and you decipher the code. And so do you remember the scene in the movie where little Ralph, he gets hunkered down and he's listening to the code and he's got his decoder ring and he's writing down the letters and he's so excited. He's just sure that the fate of the world hangs in the balance. So he painstakingly deciphers this code only for it to say, drink more Ovaltine, sponsor of the show. And he's so disgusted and upset. Well, to me, and the reason is because, see, he had a preconceived notion about what he would find once he decoded it, and then once he decoded it, he didn't want what he found. That is exactly what's going on here with these Jewish leaders. They're scouring the Old Testament, and they think they're going to decode it, and then when they actually see what it's pointing to, Jesus, they don't want, and they don't want Jesus because they had preconceived notions, and he doesn't live up to what they thought. And so they just reject out of hand the testimony of the scriptures themselves. Paul uses a great illustration over in 2 Corinthians. He says, remember when Moses, Israel sends the golden calf, and then Moses intercedes for the people, and then he asks the Lord, show me your glory. The Lord passes before him. And you remember that the Bible says that Moses, he glowed. He glimmered so strongly that he had to put a veil. Anytime he went before Israel, he would have to put the veil on. And Paul uses that then as an analogy, and he says, to this day, whenever Moses is read, whenever the law is read, a veil lies over their hearts. But when one turns to the Lord, the veil is removed. It's like you've got a jigsaw puzzle, and you've got the box top, and it shows you what the puzzle is supposed to look like. But he says, here's what's happening. They're not looking at that. All they see are the pieces. And in fact, if they do start to put the pieces together and they see what the picture is, they just decide, I don't want to know. Let's reshuffle it and try again. Paul says that's exactly what's going on, even in his own day. It's what Jesus is warning them about here in John chapter 5. By rejecting Jesus, the Jews were placing a veil over their face that obstructed them from being able to see the witness of the scripture. Now, at this point, I think Jesus maybe anticipates a possible rebuttal or a counterattack. You say we're supposed to believe in you. You say that you're equal to the Father, that what you're doing God does. You are just out to make a name for yourself. You're just out to get acclaim and praise. So look up how Jesus answers this in verse 41. I do not receive glory from people. Just like Jesus doesn't need the testimony of mere mortals, Jesus doesn't seek the adoration of mere mortals either. He didn't come to bask in the honor and praise of human beings. You remember when Nicodemus comes to him in John 3? We know that you are a teacher sent from God. No one could do these signs unless God's with them. How does Jesus respond? Just brushes aside the flattery. Says, Nicodemus, you've got to become a completely different person. A new person. All right, so that's how Jesus responds to the honor that comes from people. So what Jesus is saying to the Jewish leaders is, I'm not saying these things because I'm trying to attract some kind of following. I am devoted to God. I love God. And whatever I do, I'm doing to please him. But the same can't be said for you. He says in verse 42, I know, how does he know, that you don't have the love of God within you? Remember, in chapter 2 told us, this keeps coming up, doesn't it? That Jesus knew what was in the hearts of people. They didn't have to tell him what was on their heart. He knew. Jesus sees, you don't have the love of God. Or you're not driven by a desire to please God. In fact, if you look in chapter 3 and verse 19, the apostle has already told us what they do love. You remember what this says, John 3:19? This is the judgment. The light has come into the world, and the people loved the darkness rather than the light. Jesus says, no, I'm not out to get acclaim and fame. I love God. That's why I'm doing what I'm doing. You, on the other hand, do not have that passion. The real issue here is a lack of love. Verse 43, he says, if I have come in my Father's name and you do not receive me, if another comes in his own name, you will receive him. We know from first century history, there were many pretend messiahs who showed up. And they would attract a following, at least temporarily. Usually they ended up dead and that was the end of the story. Jesus says, I know that there are other people who come along and you'll be attracted to them. But you won't listen to me because you don't love God. And here's the issue. The fundamental issue. And it's so silly. It's what we would call peer pressure. Verse 44. How can you believe when you receive glory from one another and do not seek the glory that comes from the only God? They're more interested in receiving glory and praise and adoration. They're too busy giving each other high fives for how great they are. That they don't really want to please God and did therefore listen to God when God through his word bears testimony to who Jesus actually is. John will elaborate on this over in chapter 12 when he says in chapter 12 and verse 42, nevertheless, many even of the authorities believed in him, but for fear of the Pharisees, they did not confess it, so that they would not be put out of the synagogue. And here it is. For they love the glory, you could read honor, praise. They love the glory that comes from man more than the glory that comes from God. The Jewish establishment was too busy patting each other on the back, protecting their own position, maintaining their own standing, to ever dare to really consider who Jesus actually was. It's really funny. This happens so often when I preach through a book of the Bible. You know, this text here in John 5, it's you know, somewhat involved argument with Jesus about the testimony. And you know, I thought, you know, since this week is back to school week, aren't you guys just so thrilled about that? So I thought, well, since this is back to school, maybe I should just do something else rather than preaching through John 5. And I thought, well, no, you know, let's just keep plugging ahead. And then I realized there could not be a more timely passage to get in front of you guys than what we just read. Because what Jesus is saying to these Jewish leaders is, you don't want to accept me because you're too interested in the approval of your friends rather than the approval of God. And for those of you who are younger, not exclusively you, But for those of you who are younger, as you're about to head into a new school year, particularly those of you in public school, but not certainly not just those in public school, I mean, you well know you're going to face plenty of times over the next year where you're going to have to make some choices. Whose approval do you really want? The approval of your friends? And again, it might be at public school, but it might be at some club you're in, or it might be, quite honestly, it could even be kids here at church who's just not really interested in Jesus that much. And you're going to have to make some choices. Whose approval do you really want? Do you love God enough that you want his approval and so you're going to follow Jesus, or are you going to cave because you want the approval of your friends? Now, if it helps, let me give you some advice from an old man. The stupidest thing, and I know I'm not supposed to use them, it's stupid. The stupidest thing you could ever do as a teenager is surrender your faith in Jesus to please your friends. And among the many reasons it's incredibly stupid, 10 years from now, you're not even going to be around any of those people. You're not even going to know their names anymore. You're not even going to remember them. At the most, you might be Facebook friends. Big whoop! And so you are going to surrender your faith in Jesus in order to be in with a bunch of losers that you're not even going to know 10 years from now. That is the stupidest thing any kid could ever possibly do. Now, it's not just kids, because you and I well know there are many grown-ups who basically still live in middle school. They were promoted out of seventh grade, but their level of maturity is still seventh grade, and they are so paralyzed in the grip of trying to please the people around them, they might as well be back in middle school. Obviously, Jesus is saying these people have the very same problem. And so the issue Jesus is calling all of us to consider is this. Do you love God more than anything else? If you do, you want his approval, whatever the cost and regardless of the consequences. Or are you going to be like these people who just crumble because they want the approval of these other people? They've placed their hope, though, in somebody else. Verse 45. Do not think that I will accuse you to the Father. There is one who accuses you, Moses, on whom you've set your hope. Now, I just mentioned the story of the golden calf episode and Moses intercedes for the people. There was actually a strong Jewish tradition that even to this day, Moses is still in heaven interceding for Israel. Jesus says, I know you're counting on that. You think Moses is going to speak to God on your behalf. He is not going to. And here's the reason why. Verse 46, for if you believed Moses, you would believe me, for he wrote of me. Witness number 5, Moses. These Jewish teachers claim to believe in Moses. As a matter of fact, over in chapter 9, when Jesus heals the blind man says, Jesus healed me. They say, oh, you're just one of his disciples. We are disciples of Moses. We follow Moses. Jesus says, no, you don't. You don't believe Moses because Moses wrote about me. And if you believed him, you'd believe me. Verse 47, if you do not believe his writings, how will you believe my words? I don't really think Jesus has one specific passage in mind. I think he has everything Moses wrote from the offering of Isaac, which Eric talked about last week at the table talk, which points to Jesus in Genesis. The Passover, which is a foreshadowing of Jesus in Exodus. The Day of Atonement, which points out to Jesus' atoning death in Leviticus. The bronze serpent in Numbers. The prophet like Moses promised in Deuteronomy. From start to finish, the books of Moses all have a goal, an objective, and it is Jesus. And Jesus says, because you're not accepting me, that shows you're not really listening to Moses. You have preconceived notions that keep you from doing so. This reminds me so much of the story Jesus tells in Luke 16 of the rich man and Lazarus. You remember how the story ends? Lazarus is in paradise, Abraham's bosom. The rich man's in torment, and he says, Father Abraham, send Lazarus. I have 5 brothers. Send them up to my brothers and warn them not to come to this terrible place of torment. Do you remember what Abraham says? What do they have? They have Moses and the prophets. Let them listen to them. If they don't listen to them, everything will be fine. And then rich man says, well, no. But they would really listen if somebody rose from the dead. And what does Abraham say? If they don't believe Moses and the prophets, they won't believe even if one rises from the dead. And you know what? They didn't. Because not only do they not believe Jesus when he heals the sick and changes water to wine, and even when he rose from the dead, they didn't believe in him. Because the root of the issue is, they don't truly embrace the scriptures that Moses has written. And see, this is the thing. It doesn't really make any difference how many witnesses there are in a trial. And it doesn't make any difference the quality of their testimony. If the jury is biased, it's going to be pointless. It's like in To Kill a Mockingbird. When Tom Robinson is obviously innocent, and everybody on the jury knows it, but they've got their mind already made up, and so they render the wrong verdict. And brothers and sisters, I will just tell you, this ought to be a terrifying passage for all of us. Because what Jesus has just basically said is this: it doesn't make any difference how much you think you know the Bible. And it doesn't make any difference how often you get together and pat each other on the back and say, hey, how great we are. It is irrelevant if you don't really truly know me. And if you're not really believing in me, none of that stuff counts at all. And young ladies and gentlemen, I just want to impress this on you too. You know, we love to brag on you. We brag on you all the time. You came back from, so a lot of you went up to different camps. We bragged on you because of how great you are at camp. We brag on the young men when they come back from their camping trip. We're grateful you're alive, actually. But I mean, we brag on you when you come back from that. When the young ladies go do the things that they do, we brag on you and how great you are. A bunch of you guys came and serenaded my wife. You think I wasn't bragging on you like crazy? I mean, we love to brag about you. We love to pat you on the back. And we've got all kinds of Bible classes. It would be amazing if Nick and Eric counted up the sheer man hours every year that went into teaching you kids the Bible. But listen to what Jesus says. It doesn't make any difference how many people pat you on the back. And it doesn't make any difference how many verses you have memorized or how much you know about the Bible. If you don't know Jesus, it doesn't matter. And there is nothing that you can do to get ready for a new school year more important, whether you're a public school kid, private home school kid, homeschool kid. Just search your heart. See if you're following Jesus. Church, that's all for us. That's for all of us, of course. Well, that's the testimony. In one way, you render the verdict this morning, but in another, far more serious way, the Lord will render the verdict based on how you respond to him. Can we help you this morning? Let us know while we stand and sing together.